I'm going to start my presentation by sharing with you the commonality of the roots for most of you, or for whom most of you converted to. There were common roots, common origins, with fundamentalist Mormons and mainstream Mormons, starting from Joseph Smith and going up at least until Wilford Woodruff, and in some cases beyond. I'm going to share with you the implications of how those how certain milestones in that journey laid building blocks that enabled a fanatical leader, a Warren Jeffs, to operate a cult-like polygamist society in Colorado City, Hilldale, and now beyond. And then I will continue to share milestones with you from the time of separation of mainstream LDS Church and fundamentalist Mormonism, following specifically the path of the FLDS Church, if you will, down to the present day. I will also share with you what my life was like as a young boy growing up in Murray, Utah, at the site of the current Fashion Place Mall, as a plig kid in Pligville, if you will. And I will share what it meant and the pains, the joys, the sorrows of the separation, the ramifications in my life after leaving, and some of the things I've learned from this monumental journey, if you will. Most all of us in this room can take history back to Joseph Smith and the initial milestone proclamation that all churches are an abomination before me. This is an important milestone for the FLDS cult-like society. Then the ordination by Peter, James, and John. This is another important milestone, even for cult-like FLDS. It establishes a root, a lineage of authority, if you will, stemming directly from God, nonetheless. 1830, organization of the church. 1834, 104 section is added to the Doctrine and Covenants regarding the United Order. The United Order is an important aspect taught by many fundamentalist Mormons, not all. It's been attempted many times through mainstream LDS Church and failed, and it's been lived to greater and lesser degrees by fundamentalist Mormons, and to date, not successful. You see the remnants of such through the name of the town Orderville in southern Utah, Harmony in Utah, and the like. 1840, the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants, stating that the laws contained therein must be lived in order to receive the highest degree of glory. That's the Doctrine and Covenants section that is critical to every fundamentalist polygamist, that is plural or celestial marriage, if you will, that if in fact you are to attain that highest degree, you must have at least three wives, and if you're to attain to a higher position, a minimum of seven. 1845, Joseph Smith was martyred. Now I will comically comment, whoever made that lovely whistle sound, believe me, I've been married to three women at one time. It's no joyride, and it's not the fun and games that a lot of guys may think. Believe me, guys, we're doing good just to handle one woman. 1845, Joseph Smith was martyred, sealing a greater depth, a greater devotion, a greater commitment for the people, the followers of him, and causing an increased fervor that would last for beyond a century and a half. 1844 to 47, another milestone. This is an important milestone not only to mainstream but to fundamentalist Mormons. The exodus to Salt Lake. They were not leaving for the West just for the West. They weren't leaving just for a number of reasons on the surface that many thought. They had by that time become anti-government, anti-establishment. They were leaving the country. They were going to Mexico. At the time they left, this part of the country was part of Mexico. By the time they arrived, the Mexican-American War had been fought. The Mexicans lost. They found themselves still within the U.S. of A. Between 1850 and 1890, there's a long history of fights between U.S. Marshals, U.S. troops, and Mormondom. Johnson's army was sent out. Many of you recall the colorful stories of youth that were glamorized to crazy proportions at times relative to Daniel H. Wells, Porter Rockwell, and others who could cause consternation and havoc with the supply lines of the U.S. soldiers sent out to squelch polygamy, quote unquote. If you move beyond the story of Johnson's army and the pact, the semi-truce between Brigham Young, you move into John Taylor and you read how he was continually in hiding from U.S. Marshals for polygamy and that he had strongly stated that he would never sanction the stopping of polygamy, that he would rather have his right arm tied, torn from its socket than sign anything to dispose of polygamy. He would rather have his tongue ripped from his mouth than to have anything sanctioning the end of polygamy. These are important doctrines that we grew up with, teachings within our FLDS, fundamentalist Mormon upbringing. Any of you who want to go into the life and history of John Taylor, Joseph Smith, and others, you can read the same. Between 1890 and 1935, there was a lot of gray area. There also was a lot of black and white area. 1890, Wilford Woodruff issued the manifesto, stating that there would be no more polygamy for this life. That's an interesting wrinkle. Some men turned their backs on many of their wives, choosing to just live with one. A lot of bitterness and sorrow came at that time. Other men, and with sanctioning of high LDS officials, lived in hiding. Some moved to Mexico, maintained a quasi-fair LDS-type community. Those more stringent actually seated themselves, so to speak, but seated via, quote, revelation, unquote. An interesting story will be claims of an 1880 revelation and of John Taylor meeting with the Savior, at least claiming thereto, and passing the keys on to a Lauren Woolley, at which the separation of priesthood and church was claimed to have occurred. My roots came from that segment that instead of going to Mexico, instead of going to Canada, they went underground. My grandfather was a convert to mainstream LDS church. He immigrated from Denmark to America in 1920, went through Ellis Island. He ended up in Glendale, California, became the operations manager for Nude Sundari. He had to work here for a couple of years before he could afford to bring his love, her name was Erna, to America. They married. He had three children. When his youngest was 3 months old, my father, he woke up one morning to find Erna dead beside him. She'd strangled from tonsillitis prior to the advent of antibiotics, penicillin, and the like. Trying to be father and mother both, for some time he paid to have her sister come, thinking he could marry her and they would be happy like he was with the first. And their marriage was disaster. And having, at least through his side of the story, having tried for some time writing with an old Mormon bishop in Glendale, California, around 1935, he said, "Bishop," and I forget the name, "if a man took very good care of the first woman he was married to, didn't turn her out, but to have happiness and to take care of his children, married a second woman, would God condemn him?" He tells the story how this bishop turned to him and strongly stated, "God would condemn you if you didn't." With that, he aligned my grandfather with the fundamentalist faction in Glendale, California. He became a convert to the predecessor, precursor to FLDS, if you will. Ended up with three wives, dying in 59 at age 59. There were many crossovers. There were many stories we learned of polygamous marriages occurring in the endowment house years after the manifesto, Joseph S. Smith, and others. So I paint this a gray zone between 1890 and 1935. Around 1890, and with continued pressures from government and the like, Heber J. Grant reinforced the edict of the manifesto, howbeit being sympathetic to polygamy prior to. Under fundamentalist teachings of my roots, the teachings that we grew up with was that one day the priesthood would set the church in order. The priesthood being our leaders, if you will. And it was explained that it was logical that such should be. After all, the priesthood was given to Joseph Smith before he founded the church. So we were taught that the priesthood could organize a church, but a church could not organize a priesthood. As the years went by, there have been many, many factions, divisions, separations. There are now a multiplicity of fundamentalist Mormon groups. Such is often the case when you have peoples living in hiding, grouped together, rather outcasts or, what can I say, semi-criminal, if you will. A large group of these men, and large by the time, a few hundred, with their families, settled in approximately 1935 in Short Creek. Short Creek was called Short Creek until 1960, in which the Utah side of the town was changed to Hilldale and the Arizona side of the town changed to Colorado City. The name had such a stigma with the public that the leadership of FLDS felt it wise to change the names. Short Creek being founded where it was not by accident. It, at the time, was in a remote region of the Arizona Strip, 28 miles down a windy dirt road from Hurricane, Utah, and about the same distance from Kanab, Utah. Not much of anything in between but jackrabbits and rattlesnakes. It was by design on the state border on the logic that the states govern the laws for marriage, not the federal government. And the plan was that should any state ever try to enforce, the people could just conveniently move from one side of the town to the other side of the town. Well, there were numerous raids, so to speak, on polygamists. One raid occurred in 1944 against many in Salt Lake, Utah, and Short Creek. At that time, my grandfather was the leader of the precursor to FLDS. His name was Charles Zitting. He was imprisoned in the state penitentiary for 3 years for polygamy. He had seven wives. In 1985, there became a convenient need for FLDS to rewrite history, and he, along with two or three other prophets slash leaders, were considered not such, and the lineage changed. 1953 was an important milestone in fundamentalist polygamist history. It was a raid on Short Creek that occurred via both the states of Arizona and of Utah. The government, the governors of both states had come together and contrived a plan to engage from both sides into the town. They came in the middle of the night with sirens and flashing red lights and pulled families out. Kids were taken from parents. They were spread over foster families in Phoenix, Arizona. I was 4 years old at the time of this. My father helped bring people out of there, hidden under the canvas of the old 52 Chevy pickup. We kept them in hiding in our house in Murray. I remember as a four-year-old, one mother giving birth to a baby in the upstairs room. This had a profound effect on Americans in general and on the next generation of leaders of FLDS. The story hit Life magazine. Public outcry went across the nation. And the governments of Utah and Arizona got a real black eye. There was a monumental case, the Vera Black case, in which she won against the state of Utah, was granted custody of her children, and most all of these children, well, all of these children were returned. If you look at now leaders, very entrenched ones, many of them were young boys and girls at the time of this raid, and remember the long trakes over the sandy hills to escape this raid, if you will, which can add to the entrenchment that many feel today. 1957, I was 8 years old at the time. Courtship was banned. There had been isolated cases of parties being married by appointment, but it became firm rule in 57. There would be no more courtship. Anybody who asked to be married could be kicked out of the society, if you will. The direct correlation to this, as per teaching at the time, was that we were special covenant children, that we were held back until the last days to bring in the end of the world, the millennial reign. And it was taught at the time that we'd made covenants on the other side with those we'd decided to marry, determined to marry, and that only the prophet could align us with who we'd covenant on the other side. It doesn't take a genius to start studying what could be the ramifications if just one of those connections happened to slip. But that was the teaching at the time. 1957. All boys were to go on a work mission. The work mission was to modernize Colorado City, Hilldale. At that time, they were all living in one-room shacks, tents, no electricity, no running water. It was basic survival, if you will. I would be involved with my father and other men driving there every weekend on, quote, priesthood projects, work projects. It was on those treks, listening to the radio, hearing the stories of the South, the civil rights movement and the like, becoming tainted in my brain on how those damn niggers needed to settle down and do what they were supposed to. Tied to it, an entrenchment of the society that furthered the racism, the bigotry, the 1976 edict from the mainstream LDS church, opening their doors, offering the priesthood to the African American.
What?
78. Thank you for that correction. At any rate, what that meant was that to our FLDS society, who until that time we'd all been taught that at some time the priesthood and the church would come together, the church would recognize the true priesthood, and we would then be welcomed in to receive our temple needs and the like. All at once that changed, and what had been the Catholic Church as the great and abominable church, it now became the mainstream LDS as the great and abominable church. Approximately 1960 to present, in a progressive, stepwise move, wives and children were taught by fathers, as well as by priesthood leadership, that they belonged first to the prophet, that they could only be with their husbands as long as the husband was in unity with the prophet. Approximately 1985, a one-man rule came into effect. There was a fair amount of bickering through the mid-80s. There was a council of seven priesthood members that ruled the FLDS society. The prophet at the time, Leroy S. Johnson, was in his 90s, and he went through shingles and many other excruciating diseases of older people, but at times, anyone with logic and medical training would wonder when Leroy Johnson was speaking and when the fever was speaking. And for the devout, and especially the devout who were stroking, who were brown nosing, who would follow him in caravans wherever he went, from Lava Hot Springs in Idaho to Salt Lake to southern Utah and the like, they hung on every word. And they started even building this gentleman up. Now, I have to tell you, of all the prophets of FLDS I knew, the one unique feature that stood out on this individual is he was pro-family. And it's probably some of what kept some of us connected longer than we otherwise would. He was born in 1885 on Lee's Ferry on the Colorado River. Any of you know where Lee's Ferry is? Yeah. A little old dot on the map, the only place for a few hundred miles that humans could cross the Colorado River. A large cable had been strung across the river, and on a raft they would pull horses, wagons, and the like across the Colorado River. If you go down there, you'll see a few old log cabins, some old tombstones. You'll see grave sites of young kids, age 6, 8, 12, dying of diphtheria, scarlet fever, and all the childhood diseases that destroyed so many of our fellow Americans prior to modern medicine. Anybody, as good as they are, if they get so many followers praising them to high heaven, stroking them to high heaven, esteeming them beyond question, revering them to the nth degree, I can't help but anyone who gets old enough, miserable enough, or whatever, doesn't start taking some of it to heart. I believe many kings and queens being told how almighty they were. After so many decades of hearing it, they begin to believe they are. And so sermons started coming across from the pulpit that this prophet would never die. Sermons started coming across that this prophet, that he was as God. There was never a counter from him, and so they ratcheted up. And pretty soon it became that he was God. And the one-man rule, even so necessary for a cult-like society, was founded. In 1986, Leroy Johnson dies. It was no problem for the only council member who stood by him, the next prophet to be. He simply stands up in church and says, Leroy Johnson, he still lives. Many of us knew that that's not how it had been communicated. And we'd been told that he would be ushering in the millennial reign. Reuel Jess became the prophet. The doctrine became an ultra, ultra conservative doctrine. Some of it influenced from a Salt Lake counselor here, Guy Musser, who was an extremist, ultra-conservative, polygamous leader of FLDS. The first FLDS doctrine coming on the heels of Leroy Johnson's death, and this actually even preceded him in death, God would never allow a mentally handicapped person to become the prophet. God would never allow the prophet to lead the people astray. Those are important foundations for building blocks for a fanatical cult-like leader to step upon. From the pulpit, Christianity has nothing to do with it. From the pulpit, the living oracle prophet supersedes anything else, including all published works, including 3-in-1, other sermons of previous prophets and the like, virtually setting in place a framework for absolute totalitarianism, dictatorship, if you will. Approximately 1992 and moving forward, other examples of the cult-like controls. Through this era, the father ruling in his 80s and 90s, and he succumbing to the weakness of older age, and a son who tended to please him in any way possible, and slowly taking control and running the FLDS society prior to his father's death, with his father actually having a stroke around 1999. He was in total control until his father died in 2002. My children went to the school in the mouth of Aldeview Canyon. Warren Jeffs was the school principal. The fanatical control of dress started in the early 90s. Red was an evil color and banned. It's to be held only by the Savior. Dark colors are bad. Girls were measured on the length of their dress with a measuring tape. If the bra straps could show through on the outside, they were sent home. Wrist to ankle long underwear was mandated. And important for you all to know, this stemmed from the first garments of temple ordinances under Joseph Smith's guidance with ankle to wrist. And I grew up learning that mainstream LDS church, one of their evil things was to reduce the dimensions of that garment. And I was told the horror stories of women who rebelled at it and the like, which Doesn't surprise me. I know my own family and daughters did likewise. Children began to be quizzed about what was going on in the family. TV had been censored sometime earlier, and the pressure went up that it must be totally excluded from the household. Young children began to be quizzed on what their parents were up to, and were they watching TV? Were they attending to their prayers? It started to smack of a lot of the signs of a Hitler-Nazi Germany, if you will. It was taught that sex should only be used for making a baby. Travel beyond a 50-mile radius required approval of the prophet. The FLDS already owned all the homes. The law of consecration was ordered for those in Salt Lake, meaning that everyone was to turn their home, the title of their home, over to the FLDS Church. The people living in Colorado City and Hilldale never had title to their homes. They were on the UEP, the United Effort property, if you will. And so their homes were owned by the FLDS Church. But not only were all businesses required to sign over, but the official director of each business became Warren Jeffs, a scary entity to be running any business if it's to succeed. Families, children were taught to pray for the destruction of the world, the destruction of North America. And on the prophecy of Joseph Smith that no more than a yellow dog would be left to wag his tail, it was prophesied that by the year 2000, God would destroy all the inhabitants of North America, and only the chosen, the cream, the select, would be raised up off the earth while that occurred. Tragic tales of little nieces and nephews, young people. One of the most important, if not the most important ingredient for the mental health of a child, of any adult, is a bright vision of future. And if you destroy a bright vision of future, you destroy soul, incentive, happiness, all of the important aspects of little children. One of my little nieces is quoted to have said on her birthday prayer, "Dear Father in Heaven, please help me enjoy this birthday, for this is my last birthday." It's difficult for anyone to excel under such fear, under such terror. This is Warren Jeffs in the early 90s, a megalomaniac who has raised himself to the elevation of a Joseph Smith or a Jesus Christ, if you will. Approximately 1998, Roland and Warren Jeffs moved to Colorado City. I remember I and my wife commenting that this people, they have no idea what's hitting them. There was some 10,000 inhabitants of Colorado City and Hilldale. Pretty good sized numbers for a polygamous community. All FLDS in Salt Lake were instructed to move there to prepare for the end of the world being lifted off of the earth, and even eventually a special plot was identified as the spot they were to gather to be raised up. 2002, Roland Jeffs dies. Warren has total control. Sports are banned. Competition is evil. Laughter is evil. Members ordered to leave public schools in 1998. Some 1,500 to 1,800 students exited a school system of about 2,000 in mass, virtually crippling a school district. In amazing ways, the school board and the teachers who were FLDS were instructed to stay on. meaning that now you had a school system that was governed, run by FLDS for only non-FLDS. You see, the school district was the largest income provider of the town. Some of you may have read stories about an airplane that had been bought, which was used to ferry the profit to various locations. It took some years for the Arizona state government to rein in the situation on the school board in that district. Wives were instructed to report the wrongs of their husbands to the prophet. This led to many men being expelled. The virtual medieval-like tactic of the demand for confessions, written and otherwise, came into being. And the prophet, quote-unquote, would simply say, God has revealed to me every wrong you've committed. Unless your list of your confessions matches up to mine, it's a problem. Tragically, there are known cases of men who manufactured wrongdoings to try and satisfy the need of the evil prophet. There was daily indoctrination, virtual brainwashing, early morning sessions throughout the week, work meetings at 6 a.m. every morning, priesthood projects to keep them occupied, constant playing of Warren's sermons on tapes through every household, kids carrying individual ones in their packs, monotonous-sounding, monotone-sounding, whining sermons that would go day in, day out. The sons of Helaman were identified as a special group to police the society to make sure they were conforming. These were men of Aaronic priesthood. And true to form of Hitler's youth group, given their uniforms, complete with the sword and Helaman, and instructed to go in and counsel and quiz family members and report back if there was television or if they weren't giving their prayers or whatever else. It's been talked about for some time, Warren's infatuation with the story of the Third Reich and having read the book many times. Under Warren Jeffs, including when his father was still alive, very young girls became married off. What do I mean, Guy Musser style? It meant that, as a rule, a girl was expected to turn herself in to the prophet to be married, and she was to bring nothing of her former family with her. Such things as sewing machines have been returned to the family. They are virtually to come naked, if you will, and then for many of them, they never see their parents, their brothers, and sisters again. Masses of boys became expelled. This was virtually a necessity, as the number of wives taken by Warren and his close lieutenants went up logarithmically, exponentially, moving from 5 to 7 to 10 to 80 to 100 to 150 to 200 to 250. And for whom they married, it was not wives and children of other men as a rule. It was young girls, some of them very young. Another evil practice that became widespread with Warren was the destruction of over 200 families. What does destruction mean? It means that in the case of my father, who you see pictured in the center, the white-haired gentleman, this picture was taken about 1994, 95. I am the third one from the right in the back. All the family in 1999, October thereof, were called to report to the prophet at 6 a.m., all but my father. This was married sons and daughters and their children. As Ruland sat, Warren spoke, and the story I'm giving you is secondhand, as repeated by my brother who left the society following this occasion, Shem, the young man in the blue shirt on the far left. He stated that Warren began the proceedings by informing the family that their father was no longer their father, that he was to have all of his belongings moved out of the house within 4 hours, a house that he and family had built starting in 1973. He was moved out to an upstairs room in the next worthy son's house, as I had left the society by that time. My next eldest brother was then in charge. He had an old coal stove, stud walls, no sheetrock. He was instructed that he was to provide for the family, continue his duties as president, CEO of the family cabinet shop. The family was reassigned. Within 3 days, my biological mother was married to a man in his 80s. She was in her 70s. My next oldest mother, her sister, my aunt, was married to the prophet Ruland Jeffs as his 57th wife. The youngest was married to a man in FLDS from Sandy, Utah, who had moved down. He moved in and became the new occupant of the home. My family always prided themselves in having a comfortable home. The family was the second largest employer in Colorado City. That was one of the few yards that had grass and trees and gardens and vineyards. Our family, clear from Denmark, loved to garden. We learned later of my father being caught at 1 a.m. with a flashlight, sneaking in to water the trees and the grass because they were dying with no care, knowing that his third wife and children were sleeping in the house he was working around. At this meeting, when the family was dissolved, my 11-year-old sister turned to Warren Jeffs and said, "But if my daddy does better, can he be my daddy again?" Warren turned to her and coldly exclaimed, "There's not enough time." They're instructed to change last names. A heritage is destroyed. Histories are destroyed. They're told to destroy photo albums. When this happened, I obviously had nightmares, and I'm kind of jumping to the part of where it affected me. To become a virtual orphan at age 50 is a little challenging on the brain. The date for the end of the world came and went. Several other dates were put in place. One of the later dates was as far back as 2002, when the Olympics occurred in Salt Lake. That was supposed to be the end of the world. The cyclone that went through here, that was a sign of the end of the world. But as many dates that came and went, it was no problem to the prophet. You see, all he has to do is stand up in front of the people and say, God was ready and you weren't. I think that game finally wore thin, and I believe, being the evil genius that he is, he needed something else to maintain the people, to keep them dangling. If not scaring them with a club, then bring them with a carrot. And we'd all been taught, each generation from our childhood, the importance of our temple ordinances, covenants, and the like. And so, against all prior teachings of FLDS and fundamentalists, a large temple was built in El Dorado. And even with some similarities to some you may know of early eras, a structure that when I look at it looks more like a fortification than a temple. I believe the guy had the savvy to move people to Texas, and for such a site, I believe he could foresee the opportunity of building on the memories of Waco, Texas, and the like for the path he was heading down. This is more a contemporary picture of him. 2004, we and our family had been working with a number of expelled boys. Back in the early 90s, we had over 17 teenagers living in our house, many of them nieces, nephews. But with the movement of Warren and Rulon to Colorado City and Hilldale, it became a flood of boys. Many of them would end up in flop houses in St. George and Leverican. Some as young as 13, others in their early 20s. Boys who were either expelled, told to leave, or discouraged out. If they talked to a girl, the girl would be married to an older man. They'd never see him again. If their hair was too long, if their shirts were short-sleeved, if they went to even a G-rated movie, it was bad. This was a time that we felt we had to go public. We had our first press release on the steps of our state capitol in July 2004 announcing the challenges of these boys. We had some 120 boys scheduled to be on those steps. The day before the event, the press hit the story on Warren having sexually abused his 5-year-old nephew. And all at once, a lot of these boys became scared and were afraid by showing up on the steps of the Capitol they might be considered boys who had been sexually assaulted. So our numbers dwindled in that one-day time. 2007, recently, 2 weeks ago, he was found guilty of rape of a 14-year-old bride. If you look at the picture of this MJ, she looked like she was 12. There's many of them, very young. And just as young and innocent as an Elizabeth Smart, but versus families that will do anything to get them back, these families will do everything to keep them where they're told to go. And even knowing that they have no say, no power in it. After all, their homes are owned. Who they marry is owned. How long they stay together married is owned. They have no rights. It's total control. If they stand up, they too could be expelled. That's a rundown of the evolution, if you will, of milestones from Joseph Smith through the fundamentalist Mormon route, including the FLDS route. Many of you know of other fundamentalist groups that have very sad backgrounds, be it the Kingston group and others. I was born in Murray, Utah. Born 1949. I grew up on the house my father built in 1952. He was a carpenter at the time. He went on to become an electrician. He went on to become an excavator. When I was 12, I was running a hydraulic backhoe and laying sewer pipe. When I was 14, I was working in his machine shop and his hydraulic engineering company. I fell in love with hydraulic engineering. I thought that was quite the technology for the time, and it would have been equivalent to the computer technology of today. As a little guy, boy, back in this era, in the 50s, here you see me with my horse, Poncho. In my mind, Poncho was a horse. I'd always wanted a horse. We had a family farm. My father believed we should never raise anything we couldn't eat when hard times came. We were instructed then to store for the end of the world. We had 50-gallon drums of wheat stored in our cellar, in the basement, and out in our garage. Probably 40, 50-gallon drums of wheat. It's amazing. The house still stands. It's in the same condition. I managed to go through it some 5 years ago. Those drums of wheat are still in the cellar, but they're rotten. My mother had a nervous breakdown when I was 6. I lived with my grandmother for some time. Through the later years, we would hear from the father quite often that she was simply rebellious. She had a bad spirit. So often in my life, I've learned how important it is that I put my brain on rewind and replay the events with the data, the programs, the knowledge that I have now, reevaluating them from different perspectives. Forget that my mother had lost a one-day-old baby girl, and 2 weeks later, my younger son drowned, and within the same time period, my father married her younger sister. She received electric shock treatments. She graduated out of Jordan High about 1947, summa cum laude, editor of the school paper, played the violin. She never was much at the violin after the shock treatments. It's been a life of medication for my mother and ups and downs. Many scary things that I went through with my mother that raised me, her younger sister. Actually, at the time, seeing her more as my protector. My second mother lived in the house in Murray for 11 years without ever coming out in the daylight. We would have marshals that would watch the place. They'd be parked down the dirt lane. 300 East was a dead end dirt lane at the time. My grandfather, when he moved up from California, had bought a 40-acre farm. It was an old prison farm. He gave parcels to family and close friends in the polygamous society. There was about 8 polygamous families that lived there between the 50s and the 70s, and became known as Pligville. It could be somewhat challenging growing up as a polygamous minority in Salt Lake. Your dress obviously identified who you were as you went to public school. There could be bullies that like to stomp on you. Some of you guys know what it's like to be goosed. Hurts like hell. I came to learn what it was like to be a white minority in America. Not all of the kids that were bad were Mormon. Some were ex-Mormon, some were non-Mormon, some were atheist. But you could be teased and chided. It was a challenge. At that time, as the instigation of the work missions in Colorado City became stronger and stronger, it became obvious to me that I had to do dang good in school. It was a mandate we were to pay no attention to females. Females were as snakes. How could that be? At Murray High, they had a little teasy section in the school paper, a little train of funny lines. What if some little pipsqueak, little skinny kid, what if he was, you know, some great muscular guy? And one of the lines ended with, what if Dan Fisher got hooked, got hitched? I avoided girls like the plague. If I would have paid any attention to girls, they would have shipped me to Colorado City. I would have been put in the religious school. I had a lot of incentive not to do that. That probably was what gave me my greatest opportunity, I'm not sure. I managed to do very well in school. I got straight A's, I made the Sterling Scholar, had my picture in the paper. Maybe that had something to do with the next chapter in my life. I got an education. How was it that I could get an education? See, doctors and lawyers were evil. To go to college was evil. Most of them didn't even finish high school. I got to age 17, mid-year in my senior year. It came time for me to turn myself into the prophet. I had grown up doing all types of work. I totally expected I'd be sent to Colorado City and Hilldale. I built a real nice-looking walnut tool chest in wood shop, Murray High. I had my power saw. I was ready to go. I used the only transportation allotted to me that was motorized at the time, the old 52-shib pickup. We used it to carry everything on the farm, including manure. That helped keep the girls at bay, too. Sue, could I get my glass of water? The office for the prophet Leroy Johnson was in Sugar House, in an old home built around 1900. I went up there to turn myself in. I started climbing the old oak spiral staircase that went to the third floor where his office was. To this day, I can hear the crack and the crink of every step. Upon reaching the landing outside of his office, I knocked on the door. He invited me in. He had an old roll-top desk against the wall, a little swivel oak chair, a four-poster chair across from that. He invited me to sit down. Now, when Leroy Johnson was a young man in Lee's Ferry, he had broken his little finger. It never was set straight. It was shaped in an L. When us kids were stuck in some damn boring church service, some of our funnest diversions was watching how Leroy Johnson could access his various orifices with his little L-shaped finger. I let him know I was there to find out what God wanted me to do. He sat there silent. He started rubbing his little bald head. He had a little fringe of white hair and a shiny bald head. He started rubbing his little bald head with the hand with the little L-shaped finger. I can still see that little L-shaped finger rubbing back and forth over that bald head. And for what seemed like eternity, Finally, he looked up at me and he said, "Young man, we need a dentist." And my life changed forever. It was the greatest opportunity of my life. It scared me silly at first, but it became my greatest opportunity. I never received a dime to help going through school. I did benefit from some national defense grants and loans at the time. I knew how to work. I did remodeling jobs. I poured concrete, driveways, sidewalks, and the like. My second year in college at the University of Utah, my family moved from Murray to Colorado City. I was instructed to live with my grandmother up the street. Within a month, my father came to me and told me that the prophet had a lady he wanted me to marry. He told me the name. I didn't know who she was. I was married at age 19. I didn't want to get married. I had a whole school effort ahead of me. My grades went in the toilet. I dang near flunked out from depression and the like. I made it through University of Utah. I was accepted at Loma Linda Dental School, Southern California, Seventh-day Adventist school. When I went there, they called me a Seventh-day Mormon. None of them knew the true type of Mormon I was, save one classmate. That's a colorful story, but too long for tonight. Education is paramount. Our founding fathers and later fathers, there was a reason they mandated public education for all. You cannot have democracy without choice, and you cannot have choice in ignorance. Choice requires knowledge. It requires knowing many points of views and many schools of thoughts. Education is first and foremost, and with our Lost Boys Project, it's the principal factor we strive for. It becomes conditions for longer-term help. It became invaluable to us to discover another society, another way of life. The first week that we're in the little house where we're staying, a little house we got for $80 a month. The neighbor lady, a staunch little Seventh-day Adventist lady, she sees my wife feeding our oldest son on a cardboard box and exclaims, "That boy needs a high chair." The next day, a van from the Loma Linda hardware store pulled up and a guy got out and assembled a brand new high chair for our oldest son. And I come to discover there were a lot of good people out there, that this was a real big world with a lot of wonderful people in it, as were many of my classmates, my instructors, and the like. As the years have gone by, I've been a lucky guy. I've been able to interact with a number of people globally. This has been monumental for shaping my ability to leave. I'm married to a redhead. You see, my wife, my first wife, she had lymphedema. Her legs or ankles were always swollen. She'd get infections real easy. And near the end of the junior year, I'd gone to virtual exhaustion trying to be dad and mom and go to school and all the rest. It was July of 73. We'd drive in the old 65 ship, six banger, 65 Chev with three speeds from Southern California to Colorado City for church services and the like. It was 4th of July holiday time. Kids were out of school. I knew not to ask for family help, but only in special ways. Example, my first wife, she had a number of brothers and sisters. Her mother had 18 children, 26 pregnancies, 18 live births. Died a diabetic at age 62. At any rate, I thought I'd see if the 14-year-old girl could kind of come help us through the summer. I felt I was safe asking for the 14-year-old because they weren't marrying them that young back then, at least hardly ever. There had been a lot of family yakking about possibly me marrying her older sister the year before, and I'd gone into the prophet to set that straight, letting him know that I didn't want anything God didn't want me to have. He turned to me, he said, I'll marry her to you if you want. I said, not if God doesn't want. And he let me know she'd buck some of the time as well if he did marry her to me. So I thought I was pretty safe. At any rate, I go in, and I'm talking to Leroy Johnson, and he said, I want you to go get Alina. I drive over to their house. Alina's the older sister. I walk in the hall. She's going up and down the hall. She's combing her hair. She's wearing a dress, mostly black. I go in, I take her by the hand, she comes out in the car, we go over, we walk in his office. He invites a wife in, or two wives in for witnesses. He says, you stand there, and he married us. That's the redhead. We've been married for 34 years, battling it out some of the way. But she's helped me a lot, hitting me over the head. There's times that we really can benefit from a quality spouse who tells us off. We need to be smacked to the side of the head sometimes. Sometimes we even need to be reminded of how much we might lose if we can't start seeing straight. So I owe a lot to her, and I owe a lot to some of her daughters who had the same red hair tendency in them, smacking me to the side of my head. Never forget a Sunday school with a 14-year-old after we read the 132nd section of the Doctrine and Covenants. I found myself out in the yard talking alone with her and her letting me know that no way in hell was she going down that path. I and my wife, we both agree that yeah, we probably wouldn't have picked each other independently. We didn't have that much in common. But we've learned not only to love each other, but we fell in love. And there's a difference with loving someone and being in love. And I believe that if a man and a woman really are in love, it's almost impossible to survive relationships with others. As the years went by, I knew for some time that I and my family would be leaving. I talked to some of you before dinner. I know some of you went through the same thing. We played a game. We knew that the moment it became official, we would not see brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, parents again. So you tried to do enough of the right thing to get by, and you escaped with your freedoms when you could. The religious services became more and more extreme, more and more goofy. I came to realize the longest 2 hours of my life was a priesthood meeting. Extremism of such gargantuan proportions and preposterous levels, I found myself needing to avoid whenever I could. And finally, coming to the point of reaching my land and my line in the sand. I came to that point at which I had to choose between my kids and those that brought me onto this earth. And I came to decide that I had the greatest responsibility to those that I brought onto this earth. We found ourselves in an interesting situation. Ultra Dent had grown to become a fairly large dental manufacturer. We started as a family business on the kitchen table in 1982. We have some 850 employees today. Back in 1996, the Utah Bar Association group of lawyers put on a program as a celebration of our centennial. And they appropriately chose a subject entitled The Raid. Now, as it turns out, it wasn't one of the raids I told you about. It was actually an earlier one on George Q. Cannon by federal marshals. And they told the whole story on the polygamy situation in the Mormon church in a play. Chief Justice Zimmerman of our Utah Supreme Court played the judge at the time. It was held with a few programs in Kingsbury Hall. We were asked by our patent attorney firm to make a donation to help fund this play. It seemed like a good thing to do, so we did. Well, I had gift tickets to go to the program because of our sponsorship. After the play, I and one of our VPs were out talking on the pavement. I actually had quite enjoyed the play, and I was feeling quite exhilarated that our society had matured to where they could talk that openly about polygamy. And my mind was going back to how it was as a student on the same campus when I avoided being known as a polygamist at all cost. To our surprise, out came Warren Jeffs and some of his buddies. They'd seen the play too, complete with the list of sponsors. I got a call the next day at work from Warren Jeffs. He was informing me that they'd decided that my children were no longer welcome at the academy, that they just didn't have the right spirit. I reminded him that all of my children had been straight A in citizenship, straight A scholastically, that I personally had attended all of the PTA meetings. Nevertheless, he reinforced that they didn't have the right spirit. There's not time enough tonight to go through the game, the mind games, the human studies virtually and the like that this little guy could manipulate. But at any rate, to cut to the quick, I sat down with all my kids and I told them, guys, if you want to go back to that school, I know we can make it happen. But I don't want you going someplace you're not wanted. And every one of us in unison decided that was it. That was our official line in the sand. Here you see my redhead with my grandmother. The year's 1974. She and I both recognized that the marriage was needed to occur a year before I graduated to keep me locked on the railroad track. Where does a polygamous dentist with two wives go and practice? What society welcomes them in? My grandmother, my biological grandmother, grew up in Tremont, Utah, mainstream LDS church, staunch LDS. At age 29, converted by my grandfather, the then prophet, married him at age 29. Taught in the one-room schoolhouse in Tremont, last name Christensen. A lot of Christensen Mormons from Box Elder County. She was strict to strict, You always knew where you stood. Strict Victorian principles. She taught me in my early Sunday school days the stories of Joseph Smith, the golden plates, on and on. For me to make the transition, it meant I had to replay and replay and replay multiple times the stories, but bringing them in perspective with what I knew now. In transition, at times it meant nightmares, it meant bad dreams, post-traumatic syndrome, if you will, from the early indoctrination, from earliest recollection. I love my grandmother to this day. Some of the ramifications of leaving. I breathe the fresh, precious, self-evident truth rights to be equal, free, and pursue happiness. There is nothing more valuable than freedom. There is nothing more meaningful than liberty. I understand full well why our founding fathers fought and died for freedom. And I pray that this country will always be willing to fight for freedom. I believe that if ever we become a society which does not maintain a certain minimal mass of fellow Americans who are willing to fight and even pay the ultimate price for freedom, we will lose freedom. Freedom is not something you flip a light switch on. It's not something you pass laws on and mandate and thou shalt have. It's something that every member of a society has to be willing to pay prices for, to maintain. Another ramification is I'm an apostate, I'm an enemy. I've talked to some of you, you have similar stories. I do believe it's a little more black and white with the FLDS. It's totally black and white. There is zero communication that's to occur. You are worse than dead, a son of perdition, if you will. It means that I haven't spoken to my eldest daughter in 10 years. Haven't spoken to most family members in that time. Something that I quite prize. My grandfather died when I was 10. But there were values he taught me, such as keep your hand open to give. It is open to receive. You never can receive with a closed fist. He died when I was 10, but he made an impact on my life. I'm a lucky guy. I got 26 grandchildren. Most of them I get to see. Wow. Most of my children I get to see, save the one daughter. That's a good benefit of having made the choice when I did. If I could have had a better crystal ball, I might have had all 14. I can focus more on subjects that improve my family, my community, and the world. It's great when one's brain is liberated to reach beyond survival, to reach beyond day-to-day. In a large polygamous family, you're just battling to keep food on the table and school clothes coming. If you're living in a polygamous family as the head of the family, you're having to sort through battles and feelings and jealousies and hates and all the rest. The big love program's a joke. You know, there are quality reasons that women have innate, virtually instinct, love and protectionism for their offspring. It comes from eons of time. It is not surprising if a mother should tend to protect her own at the cost of others more. There are many situations that don't come out on the big love. Children who can be abused. Yes, one can always claim that in a polygamous family, a kid doesn't become a latchkey kid, that there's always a mother there. That's true. But what happens if the mother who's there has a son that abuses the other mother's daughter when she comes home from school? I used to believe that there was no greater incidence of sexual abuse, incest, and the like with polygamous versus non, but as I've gotten older, I believe that just the setting of multiple mothers' kids, and in the case of FLDS, all jammed under one roof, can create a setting which can be scary for that at times. I've even talked to a young man who explained he looked at the other mother's kids different than his mother's. I can keep a good relationship with most of my children. That's fabulous. That's important to me. I've come to enjoy deeper all people of this world. I remember how I would always look at a Gentile a little bit different than one of my own. How the babies that were born of the FLDS being covenant children were somehow superior than some other baby. As I look back and replay that on my instant rewind, I'm sickened at the thought that I could be so damn bigoted and judgmental. I revel in the squeezing every little baby. Black, white, pink, purple, they're gorgeous, everyone. I've come to truly enjoy the value, the satisfaction of doing right things for right reasons, just because it feels good inside. Not because of any promise in an afterlife, not because thou shalt, but just because it feels like the right thing to do. And I believe one of the greatest travesties that can occur is when we have taken from us the opportunity to do right things just because they feel right. It's one of my little granddaughters. Her name's Zoe. The Joseph Smith story, the Book of Mormon story, and why I'm not LDS today. Well, first of all, for what I know, you know, for what I learned growing up under fundamentalist Mormondom, for the stories that were kept from the teachings to the mainstream LDS, I could never become mainstream LDS. I get asked this so often, and I will tell you, I have many wonderful friends and people that I love, that I hug, who are mainstream LDS. I have Jewish friends, I have Catholic friends, I have atheist friends, you name it. But there are certain logics that would preclude me from going down that path. And we could make a whole meeting of that. There's not time enough for that tonight. But one is plural marriage and everlasting commandment. I can't reconcile a mandate and commandment that on one side is required for the highest degrees of glory, but on the other side doesn't match with math and biology. And this was a basic, fundamental realization I came to in my move from FLDS. There's very close to 50% boy babies born and 50% girl babies born. It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that if some men are marrying multiple girls, some boys got to go. My mother, in 2000, trying to dispel my pain, my anger over the atrocity of this destruction of my family, and we came to the subject of polygamy, and she brings up that God ordained in the animal kingdom that many male animals have many females. So, Mom, are we reverting back to the animal kingdom? So, Mom, how about the other animals we esteem that mate for life? I'd rather be a dove than a lion, Mom. The story of the blacks, the African Americans, I can't reconcile that. I could not say from my early teachings, and you can go find it. Back in the 50s, these books weren't found in Deseret Book. They were found in Sam Weller's bookstore. Many of these books were passed on down generations of fundamentalist Mormons. But Joseph Smith taught that if you had sex with a black, you would have Negro blood in you. Why should such a teaching ever even have to be made? And certainly it connected to his plan to have them all exported to Africa, to his plan to his command that they never hold the priesthood, that they were the sons of Cain, that they sat on the fence, and on and on. And I cannot reconcile in my mind how, knowing of those teachings of Joseph Smith, I could embrace mainstream LDS today. It's not to say that I don't even respect more a church who can adjust with the times, but I cannot embrace the foundations that got it there in the first place. Blood atonement. Warren Jeffs has moved to scary levels on his teaching on blood atonement. His quotes come from Brigham Young and others out of the Journals of Discourses. Those were books we read all the time. The early teachings of Brigham Young, John Taylor, Heber C. Kimball, Parley P. Pratt, on and on. These are teachings that are fundamental quotes that people like Warren Jeffs use to expand and to predict the time of blood atonement. The Adam God Doctrine, Journal of Discourses, Brigham Young, teaching that Jesus wasn't God, Adam was God. That's how we were raised. And then that fell out in the 80s. And that there would be 144,000 who would become gods into their own right. I start analyzing such things when I put my brain on rewind and I start doing the math and the billions of people, and that logic just goes out the window, and you start working from some fixed number and it starts to emulate the requirement that everybody have a preordained life, that everybody therefore must come to this earth as virtually puppets on a string to just dance out what they're going to dance out because it's ordained. There's this number and there's just got to be that number. And there must be certain ones that are going to make it preordained and certain ones that aren't. And we're just the puppets. I can't make sense to that. I can't reconcile that. Thanks for the 5-minute warning. I've come to realize the happiness of not living throughout eternity with secret covenants, control, and fear. The thought of living forever in the way we were living, of total control, that's frightening. That's spooky. And I've come to realize the importance that dissolution is okay. Now, sure, it would be great if there's a hereafter. That would be wonderful. And it would be great if we all had our families. But as soon as the human race, individually or as a group, succumb to an idea of being dissolved, unless you do X, Y, Z, you play into their hands. Other humans manipulate you based on the fear of utter second death, dissolution. You must come to a point of realizing if that happens, it's okay. The Diversity Foundation and the Lost Boys. Our lives begin to end the day we become silent upon things that matter. This is America today, folks. It's a tossed salad of all colors. my granddaughter, Casey, my oldest granddaughter, third in from the right in the middle row. She came home from school after going to her first day down in Southern California. She was afraid to death when she went to school. She didn't know anybody. Her Nana, my redhead, calls her. So, Casey, how was your first day of school? Oh, it was okay, Nana. So, Casey, you got a good teacher? Yeah, got a good teacher, Nana. So, Casey, did you make any new friends? Yeah, made 3 new friends, Nana. Well, what's their names, Casey? I don't know, Nana, but one of them's brown and one of them's black and the third one's peach. Children are born to love. They're taught to hate. Our diversity foundation, we print pallet loads of comic books and coloring books. We funnel them through teachers here in Utah, Rocky Mountain, throughout the country, no charge, teaching the value of diverse humans. The Lost Boys, particularly since the flood eviction of Warren, we know there's some 900 of them out there. We work actively with about 200 of them via schooling, via helping them get a job or place to locate. They're a tight group. They're only families themselves. We used to think we could have dads adopt them, and they're not built that way. They hang to themselves. They only trust themselves. This is the Diversity Foundation. We do take donations to help these boys. If any of you are interested, you certainly can look up the Diversity Foundation and go to the Lost Boys subject. At this point in my life, I've come to realize the value, the benefit of the saying of Ralph Waldo Emerson. This is my principal religion today. It doesn't mean I don't believe in some fabulous teachings of that famous entity 2,000 years ago, one of them that I believe to my bootstraps, the value of stay childlike. Another one, the greatest of all is the servant of all. Those are invaluable to me. I'll never belong to a church organization. I've seen too much control in my life. My oldest son joined the main LDS church after our separation from FLDS. He could only handle it about 3 years. It reminded him too much of his roots. Ralph Waldo Emerson, he stated, "That which lies behind us and that which lies before us are tiny matters compared to that which lies inside of us." I have become so nauseated by the number of hours spent day in, day out of humans proclaiming that they knew what occurred in a prior life and what will occur in a next life. And they twitterpate and regurgitate and vominate until after a while they lose the gorgeous opportunity to embrace and hug the present, to live the now, to do the best you can with what you know. I believe if God would have wanted us to have known about a prior life or a next life, he would have let us know. I believe he is more logical than to just say, this one dude, this one guy gets to know that, and he can then manipulate everybody else with it. I think God's smarter than that. And I believe to my bootstraps, if God is this great entity that so many entities, so many people claim him to be, that whether he or she or whatever it is or whatever it isn't, that if we've got the right stuff inside of us, it just doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if there's umpteen, you know, ordinations for dead or baptisms for dead or somebody's not aligned with somebody else. If you've got the right stuff inside, you're okay. And if you're not okay, God's not this great, marvelous entity everybody thought he or she was. So I encourage people to look inside and work to have the right stuff inside. With the Lost Boys, we have to continually remind them not to throw the baby out with the bathwater. There's many good things you learn from your mother's knee. Honesty, integrity, a work ethic, quality human pride. Boy, we need that in today's world. It's foolish if we trash it. We should hold our heads high from who we were, but be proud of who we are and keep the best of what we got and just flush goofiness, not goodness. That's all.